You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people. Hello everyone, I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Sally Douglas.
And Sally and I are today talking about the readings for Trinity Sunday. And in particular, we're going to focus on Proverbs 8, verses 1 to 4 and verses 22 to 31 and Romans 5, verses 1 to 5 and John 16, verses 12 to 15. Now, this is a, in some sense, is it a high festival for the church? Probably for some churches, but for others not. I do quite like Ben Myers, who's got umpteen, what does he call them? Rules, tweeting the Trinity.
That's right.
Because heresy is meh, and he's got something like 70 little hashtag points about the Trinity and what not, what to do and not to do about talking about it, dealing with it, thinking of it. And he thinks we should abolish the day of Trinity Sunday because of the temptation or the sense it suggests that it's there simply so we have this impossible opportunity to explain it,
which
once a year, and then we forget it.
Yeah. Well, and there's some merit. I'd actually love Trinity Sunday, but I also resonate with Ben's concerns.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like most things, it's not either or. So we're here to help people think about it, not to explain it, and the joy of it, the fullness of it, and the relationality of it, and all the things. And we're going to begin with Sally, who is the font of all knowledge about the first particular book, Proverbs. And Sally, as someone who knows a lot about and has thought a lot about this, it is hard to answer a question like this. But as we approach this passage today, what are some key things that people must absolutely take into account, not forget at all, keep in mind when they're parsing these verses and the nature of the female divine, how we talk about her and all the things?
And why is the reading here?
Why is it here?
Yeah. So I think this is a really great first question because of the way in which theological education has and biblical studies has continued for centuries, often people don't have any real knowledge about who this female divine figure is. And it's like, well, this is a weird reading to just slot in here in the lectionary when it's Trinity Sunday. So I'm going to invite us all to engage with the text here in Proverbs, but also then reflect on the earliest church. So there is this female divine figure in the Old Testament, and here she is in Proverbs. So the very beginning, does not wisdom call out? Does not understanding raise her voice? On the heights, beside the way, at the crossroads, she takes her stand. So this is Proverbs 8 verse 1 and and the following verses, the first part of our reading. This female divine figure is called Chochmah in Hebrew, and it means wisdom, and Sophia in Greek, which also means wisdom. A couple of things to note, she's always imaged as female in Jewish sacred texts here in Proverbs, but also in Sirach and Baruch and the Wisdom of Solomon. We don't know why she's present in these texts, and people have all kinds of different theories about why she's present, and we might get a chance to talk about them, but we actually don't know why. What's astonishing, though, is that she's present and she's not edited out. Like in a monotheistic faith, we have and a patriarchal culture, we have this female divine figure, and here in Proverbs she's not presented just as a wise woman. If you keep reading the passage that we have for the lectionary from verse 22, it becomes really clear that she is pre-existent. She is with God in the beginning. And this whole hymn that she speaks about herself in, really, like it's a hymn to herself, the Lord created me at the beginning of his work. It's almost like another creation story. And the emphasis throughout it is that she has been with God from the beginning as all things are created. And the Hebrew is a bit ambiguous about whether she is watching God create towards the end of this passage or whether she is like an architect actually creating. And different later texts interpret that in different ways. So in the Wisdom of Solomon, she is the one through whom all things are created. And that already might be ringing a few bells of familiarity for Christians, because that's kind of, it is exactly the same language that is used of Jesus, and that's not an accident. So she's female, she's divine, she's with God in the beginning, she's somehow involved in creation, either observing it being created or creating with God. In this passage, God delights in her and she delights in humanity. So it's a very alive kind of vital imagery of God. Now, what's astonishing, and the reason why this passage is linked together in the lectionary for Trinity Sunday, is that in the earliest church, she became the central figure for diverse Jesus communities trying to make sense of how Jesus was the God one. Like, this is such a radical notion that so I think sometimes we're too familiar with the text, we don't realize the shock of them. So
I agree.
Earliest Christians aren't just claiming that this guy was killed by the state and then raised. They are absolutely claiming that.
Which is scandalous.
Which is scandalous. But then they go even more scandalous. They say this guy is God from God. Mm. Like, so in John's gospel, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and then the Word became flesh. So they're making extraordinary claims. And then that he allows himself to be killed. So as these earliest communities are kind of grasping for how to give language to, we believe in one God, because they're almost all Jewish at the start, one God, and yet God has somehow dwelt with us in flesh, they turn to Sophia to give like an architectural framework for speaking of that. So we have that in the prologue in John's gospel. Jesus is imaged as Sophia throughout that. And I'm not the only expert, but I've written extensively about it, so you can go and follow up these resources. We don't have time to track them all. Yeah, you're going
to
ask.
Oh, well, I was just wanting to ask something more specifically about the relationship with logos.
Yes.
Is that simply, I don't mean simply.
No.
I mean it's another Greek term.
It is. So why is the word logos used in the prologue and not Sophia? That's another debate, which I, again, discuss in my work. There are different views about this. I'm a bit when we don't know, we don't know. So yeah. I tend to be a bit agnostic. Martin Scott, who's written an entire book just on John's gospel and the way in which Jesus is imaged as Sophia throughout, he suggests that possibly the author of the prologue, or the authors, it could be a collective thing, because Jesus is incarnate among us as a man, chooses the logos language rather than the Sophia language. I mean, I think I'm quite attracted to that interpretation, but others argue it's just a patriarchal way of subliminating that this is Sophia. That could also be true. We don't know. But in Matthew's gospel, Jesus is imaged as Sophia. Paul calls Jesus the wisdom of God, Sophia of God, in 1 Corinthians. There's these hymn fragments in Colossians, the Colossians hymn, and in Hebrews as well. Again, so different communities all imaging Jesus as Sophia. And
to interrupt, but which we haven't highlighted explicitly. Well, I certainly haven't as a preacher, I apologise.
No, So I had studied so deeply in as a candidate, like different, like deep New Testament studies, and it just didn't come up. It was only when I did my doctoral research, and I'd heard a tiny passing reference to her, and I'm like, oh, this is probably some
loopy.
Someone's making, like, there's probably two verses and someone's just blown it out of proportion. So I was utterly astonished when I came to the text and went, oh my goodness, it's everywhere. And James Dunn, who's a really important, solid biblical scholar, I just want to read this quote from him. So mainstream New Testament scholar, says, the wisdom of God that Jesus was very early on described in terms drawn from pre-Christian speculation, so from Jewish speculation concerning divine wisdom, Sophia, Chochmah, is the nearest thing we have to consensus in this whole area of early Christology, like the dominant image. But it gets suppressed all the time as well. So biblical scholars and I'm not saying that James Dunn did this intentionally, but he calls Sophia divine wisdom, which she is. But if you don't know that divine wisdom is always female, well, then how are you going to get that? Like, you just, so there's an acknowledgement and a sublimation at the same time. So as these earliest communities were seeking to make sense of how Jesus could be the God one, this treasure from their Jewish tradition became incredibly important. So that's why we have this reading this week. So if this is new to you, you might want to there's a long podcast where I talk all about the details, the Nomad podcast, if you don't want to read a book. Yeah, you can read my book. You can read other books too, but there's my latest book is an accessible, popular level book about this evidence and what it might mean for the church today. It is profound. Like this, not my book, my book might be, but this area of theology is profound, that these earliest Jesus communities. And what I think is really interesting is Justin Martyr, who's a early church writer writing in the 130s to the 160s, when he's writing to a Greek audience, or he writes his letter to the emperor, he describes Jesus as logos, And when he's writing to a Jewish audience, he describes Jesus as Sophia.
Oh, interesting.
Really interesting. Both meaning the same thing. Like he refers to Proverbs as the biblical and theological backbone for this, but he's speaking to audiences who are less and more familiar with this imagery. So that's why she's here, and that's how Jesus imaged as her, and it is foundational for Matthew's gospel and John's gospel in particular, and for Paul and other early church writers.
Mm. When I was reading your book, I was also really struck by the conversation about the type of woman who's depicted.
Yes.
I mean, not the submissive, not the quiet, not the...
Not really mothering either.
Not mothering.
No.
But I love the words you used, I think, was loud, public, and what was the other one? Demonstrative.
Yeah. And she is. I mean, so
not quiet and submissive.
No. So in the opening, if you read the beginning of Proverbs, you'll see her again. She's in the first chapter, and she's at the street calling to people, which is the domain of men, saying, come to me, listen to me. It's so interesting that she's presented in this way. There's a tiny reference to her being like a mother in Sirach, but mostly she is imaged as this the fount of wisdom and knowledge and life, like all who come to me have received life. Like these are profound images. And then in Proverbs, if you keep reading in Proverbs 9, she's the one who prepares the feast.
I was just going to say, well, she's an architect. Like,
An architect.
Yes. I mean, you can't say, well, she's depicted as a homemaking, cooking person. No. Like, well, she's the Jesus figure presiding at the supper.
That's right.
At the risk of, you know.
No, you're absolutely right. And she offers the bread and the wine. And so in Proverbs 9, and then in Sirach, which she has the bread of learning, and she actually says in Sirach, come and eat on my fruits. Like it's clear that John's gospel is deeply in dialogue with Sirach. And interestingly, in Sirach, she says, and you'll hunger for more. And in John, Jesus says, come to me and you'll be satisfied. So it says, I think my sense of the text is that the proclamation is that now that Sophia has dwelt with us in person in Jesus, the fullness is among us, like, and the full satisfaction is accessible now. So it's incredibly, I mean, this might be, if you've never heard of this, you really might think you've tuned into Loopy Land Show, but this is in the biblical text and extraordinarily important for the early church, and it just gets suppressed more and more over centuries.
Well, what you're highlighting with great energy is what one other little principle of Ben Myers, that the Trinity itself is a witness to the Scriptures, Old Testament and New,
yes,
and of their continuity,
yes,
and it provides, he says, well, language, but also process, proceed, like it's not just about language, it's about being and procedure,
yes,
kind of language he uses for it. But yes, that it's tying together the traditions and trying to say what is truthful as we can, that is coherent and life-giving.
Absolutely. And it's grounded in experience.
Yes.
Go to the New Testament.
So, which takes us to, I think, the Gospel of John for today.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't.
And we can do a little bit of both, I think.
Okay, where would you like to?
Well, just briefly on Romans. So, I think I understand why the lectionary composers have chosen Romans, because it does speak of the persons of the Trinity. So through Jesus Christ, we are drawn into this relationship with God and the Holy – I mean, it's got this beautiful imagery of the Holy Spirit being poured into our hearts. Mm. And I want to say a bit more about that in a second, but before we do, I just have to say, if you have this passage in church, I think you have to do a disclaimer right at the outset, because it talks about how suffering produces endurance and then character and hope. That does not always happen.
No. Well, wouldn't it be true enough it doesn't? But I was just thinking often, usually, the suffering referred to in the gospel like this is suffering that comes particularly from being a witness to Christ.
Possibly
not,
for
not
Paul
suffering in general.
But unfortunately, you know, that whole what doesn't kill you make you stronger. It's like, oh, my goodness. Actually, sometimes it does kill people. Like
absolutely, it does.
So if the passage is being read just to, at the very outset of a reflection, if you just to name that this is, as you said, it's possibly, Paul's possibly referring to suffering as a witness, but also even in that, like we sometimes it doesn't produce these things. And when it does, it's not through our own effort, it's through the grace of God. But both in So now that we've qualified that, both here and there are multiple other passages in the New Testament, in the epistles, but also in, as we see in John, I think what these writers are pointing to is experience, Fran. They are experiencing the Spirit being poured out in them, and they are experiencing the ongoing presence of the risen Jesus. So it's not just that Peter and the beloved disciple and Mary Magdalene and others and the couple on the way to Emmaus, that they experience the risen Jesus. This is an ongoing presence in these Jesus communities where their hearts are being transformed. And it's almost as though, because they're almost all Jewish, it's so monotheistic, that they have no other choice but to begin speaking of God in this way, because the experiences are so profound. Of the one that we knew witnessing among us, healing and teaching and challenging us and feeding us, is continuing to heal and teach and challenge and feed us through the power of the Spirit. And so this incredibly tender language of the Holy Spirit being poured into our hearts is used because it's pointing towards these ongoing experiences, not just that Paul's having, but that we're all having.
I was just going to say, I mean, this is the risk of pointing out the obvious, which seems to be the case a lot with preaching, but what you've just described, that dynamic, that action, that consciousness of, is what we're – I mean, we're still doing that.
Exactly.
That's what we're doing. And when we forget we're doing that, we become – it becomes dead and flat.
Correct.
And we wonder what we're all there for.
Exactly.
Except to keep the building open or something.
Fran.
But, you know, where is the movement of the Spirit here? What – and then we use this language. I mean
– yeah.
I think people, we can be othering the text in that sense of going, well, that's what they were doing. Well, hello.
Oh, I completely, completely agree with you. And I think in John we see the same thing. So John, in this long farewell speech, we've already heard.
Quite a bit from.
Yeah, extraordinary imagery of, you know, the God of the universe making home with us. Like that is
well, that's
so
the other thing.
Intimate.
Sorry to go back to the Proverbs, but she is expansive and intimate.
Exactly.
And, you know, which is who God is for us.
That's right. So in the Wisdom of Solomon, she, all things were infused with her energy. She brings about all things, orders all things well, and yet she makes homes in our hearts. It's exactly the same.
Yeah. It's the same movement.
Exactly.
So this John, I mean, this passage in John is so brief, like it's three verses, but it is what the Trinity is.
Yeah. So read it. Do you want to read it out?
Yeah. I still have many things to say to you, but you cannot bear them now. I think that when the Spirit of truth comes, he will guide you into all the truth, for he will not speak on his own, but will speak whatever he hears, and he will declare to you the things that are to come. He will glorify me because he will take what is mine and declare it to you. And all that the Father has is mine. For this reason, I said that he will take what is mine and declare it to you.
So it's absolute conviction that the Spirit continues to draw us into truth. And the flip side of that is cut away the lies. And I really love that. And I'm thinking about our culture right now. I mean, there are lies in every culture, but it feels like our culture is driven, like secular consumerist culture, driven by the lie that you're not enough and that you don't have enough.
And that there isn't enough.
Exactly. Where if we allow the God of Jesus Christ to come to us, who says, come to me, all you who are weary, and who says, I know the hairs on your head, and who says, I want to make home with you, and who the Spirit will be dwelling with you, all of those lies are disrupted. It's like I keep imaging the Spirit as the advocate, as sometimes with a megaphone or with a hacksaw, like getting us free from the lies that we get embedded in.
One of the things I mentioned in the last podcast episode I was in here was when stuck with a text, do as Anna Carter Florence suggested, which is you preach the verbs. With the last John passage I was looking at, when you do that, I haven't done it with this one, so I have to be quick. But they're words like believe, love, God, sent, they're incredibly action filled.
Yes.
They sound abstract. You could say, oh, well, it's very, well, it's actually not. It's about being and not non being. And when you were saying, you know, the popular narrative of not enough. Actually, what really struck me, I took the verbs out and they were all like that, and they're like that here. Glorify me, I will declare to you, and so on. Is that we live in fear of the opposites of those things all the time.
Absolutely.
So God is there using and being and enacting these things and calling us into that.
Yeah.
And actually we spend most of our time worried we're not enough, worried we will be rejected.
That's right.
Worried
we're not in.
That we don't believe the right way or whatever that is.
Yeah.
Anyway, that really broke and opened the liveliness of the text for me this year.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I think that the dynamism in the text and in the whole of Christian faith, it is not actually a faith that is based on agreeing with a set of tenets. It's a faith about calling to this dynamic relationship. One last thing I'd love to say about the Trinity that I've continued to be thinking about and writing about is that if, and I'm talking theologically here, if we at a theological level believe that we are made in the image of God, so I'm not talking about literalist creation story stuff, but that claim in the first creation story, we're made in the image of God, and God within God's self is in community, three persons and yet one, what does that tell us about what we are intended to live into? It means we're intended to be ourselves, our own person, to have our boundaries and integrity and to acknowledge our particular charisms from God, our gifts from God, and our weaknesses that need hacking off and, you know, challenging and so on. But we're also called into communities of love, of giving and receiving love. And I feel like so often we're one or the other. We kind of lose ourselves in the community, or we stay so cut off that we're not in community. Like, we all tend to go one way or the other.
So maybe my last thing I'd like to say is when people – preachers are talking about the Trinity, but also every Sunday, the Eucharist is the place. Like, when we pray, as we do at the Thanksgiving, it is about God in our bodies.
Yes.
And the in us and through us.
Yes.
And it's it's about, it's not just stuff we find out about this process, but, you know, our bodies are transformed and into God's body.
Yeah.
And the ethic of being around that is love.
It is. And do you know what I love about – what has been really striking me recently is it embodies the truth that cuts through the lie. There is enough. There's enough bread. There's some – and guess what? You've got a place in the circle. There's a place for you.
Yeah, and that's Rublev's icon, which you can never overuse with this
– yeah.
You know, in this – well, ever. But I was going to go back to the thing about love. What was I going to say? Oh, that's right. So there is that dynamic of love we've talked about, and that for John is particularly pronounced.
Yeah.
But it's not just for our own sake, which is glorious and fabulous, but in John it's for that the world may believe.
Amen.
That God sent Jesus.
Yeah.
So there's this sort of incredible expansiveness.
There is. And then I think it always leads to the question of, would people notice love in us? Like, just in our normal interactions, are they noticing that love cascading out of us?
That is vulnerable and fragile and imperfect, right, but actually profoundly powerful.
Yeah.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.